And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Geico presents yet another voicemail from your roommate.
Hi. So, about the kitchen. Turns out, when there's a grease fire, you're not supposed to throw water on it. Who would have known, right? Anyways, the fire department is here, and it's totally cool. Give me a call back when you get a chance.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected, like if danger is your roommate's middle name. Visit geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
Hey, this is Otacon. You're listening to This Week in Geek with Mike the Birdman Dodd and the rest of the Twig crew right here on thisweekingeek.net. Are you listening? Snake? Snake? Snake!
Who disrupts my coronation?
Everyone has been destroyed because of this freak. I won't allow it!
These babies just saved this lame death party!
The internet can be your window to the world, or an open door that lets cyber criminals in. Online theft, webcam spying, and identity fraud are all on the rise. But you can stay safe with Kaspersky Lab, the world's most awarded internet security. Kaspersky protects your money, privacy, identity, and data with technology perfected over 20 years. So keep exploring. Kaspersky Lab will keep you safe online. Learn more at Kaspersky.com.
To Twig, the flagship of stupidity. I am one of your deuce hosts today. That's right, I am Mike the Birdman Dog, one of the many founders of Twig, but I'm joined with, on my right,
Mr. Christopher.
Holy
you said
shit.
Deuce.
Deuce. That's right, he's back! That's right, we are without the producer, Alex, this week, as he's actually going outside and doing some manly man work with a tool belt, a construction hat, and little safety goggles he got. He's rebuilding his mommy's deck.
Oh, Deck. All this time I thought he's been saying dick.
Well, his mom's dick is indeed huge and powerful. Aren't we off to a professional start this week? But yes, we are back here on the show. Now, one thing I have to address right off the hop is we are experiencing some website troubles and some RSS troubles. So if you want a specific episode, if it doesn't populate in your RSS feed, you may need to download directly from the website. And it should work fine that way. So hopefully we should have it sorted out in just a couple of days. It's basically redirecting where the RSS feed pulls from. Because it turns out, someone explained it to me quite simply, we have too much content. We're at 1,200 plus episodes and the old feed just can't handle it anymore.
We're just too productive. Too big for our britches.
Isn't that a problem to have? Oh, and you just had to say it like that, didn't you? I hate you.
So, that's a segue.
That is a segue. So my wife, in her infinite wisdom, ordered me a pair of shorts from the fat guy store to do all fat guy shorts, kingsizedirect.com. And she bought me a pair of shorts. She slipped when she ordered them. I'm not going to tell you what size they are, but let's just say Lacey and Tristan, his fiance, could fit in them comfortably. And then they started thrusting in them. Guys, please don't bang in my shorts.
It will now enter the lexicon. Please don't bang in my shorts.
It was embarrassing to say the very least. I was just like, jeez. But hey, that's just how things go in, well, Albuquerque. Sorry, I was listening to Weird Al the other day.
I love Albuquerque and Weird Al.
I was just thinking just how ridiculous that song was and how the entire story revolves around him eating sauerkraut.
That's all I'm really trying to say.
And I was just like, you know what? I kind of like sauerkraut, but I kind of have it being force-fed for 26 years. Just segue thought there. Anyway, coming up on the show this week, we have some rather exciting reviews, a brand new review coming to you from me. I take a look at State of Decay 2 on the Xbox One, also available for PC, and we take a look at an RPG. That's right, since I am a terrible warrior and the game master of the Cambridge Chronicles, I'm going to be looking at The Fall of Deltagreen from Pelgrim Press. We'll be talking about that a little later in the show. You also may hear these reviews again on Turd or Treasure, depending on whether Alex needs enough content. But anyway, we're also going to be talking about the news that was in the world this week. We'll talk about the weird news. Some of the topics that we'll be talking about, the big elephant in the room involving a little-known actress known as Roseanne Barr. We're also going to talk about some of the latest leaks from the vaults of Bethesda. And a little game you may have heard of involving little pocket monsters. And I don't know, Tristan, what else do we got this week?
Well, we want to talk about the potential for alien life to really misunderstand that little probe that we sent out long, long ago with pictures and other weird crap all over it, and how you could rig your Google Assistant to do whatever you want, including kill people.
That's going to be amazing. The birth of Skynet, only here on Twig, the flagship of stupidity. So, guys, we'll be right back. We're going to throw things over to me right now with one of our many reviews on the show. Also, we have Satan's Pantry, as we often always do. So we'll be back here, guys, right here on Twig, the flagship of stupidity, because, hey, I can't quite screw up nearly enough times on this show. So without any further ado, hey, guys, we're taking a look at State of Decay 2, coming to us from Undead Labs and Microsoft. This game is available on Xbox One and Windows PC. So I've spent a chunk of time with State of Decay 2 over the last little while, and I'm kind of conflicted with this game. Do I like it? Do I not? Do I love it? Do I hate it? And I'm rather undecided, so I'm going to give you my personal experience that I've had with this game thus far. So this game does give you a choice of four different sets of characters. You get some brothers, some siblings, a gay couple, and old war buddies, I guess, so to speak. I chose to play as the gay couple because they just seemed the most interesting to me. So the game starts out where you're basically scavenging for supplies, you're looking for food, and you come across a military camp where they're like, oh man, there's no food here, but there's this thing called the blood plague, and your partner eventually gets infected with this blood plague, and you have to help cure them. And basically, once you play through that intro slash tutorial where you cure them of the blood plague, you have to work on setting up bases around one of three different maps. I chose the one in the foothills because why would I want to go anywhere else? That just makes sense to me. Go away from civilization, away from the bad zombies. So you do that and you go around to different houses, construction sites, military outposts, convenience stores, even laundromats and stuff like that. Basically places you'd find in the everyday real world, and scavenge for supplies. You're looking for medicine, food, ammo, gas, and I think there's one more resource. Oh, building supplies, so you can help build up your bases. Now, your bases can come with things like watchtowers, gardens, infirmaries, which you're going to need to help cure the blood plague, which may sound like a big threatening thing, because in the State of Decay games, permadeath is a thing, and you can lose survivors to the blood plague, but you can also just die from getting your ass kicked. But basically, you go out there, you kill a bunch of these new special plague zombies, collect so many samples, you can craft a cure for them, and they're fine. Although you too can become infected. I had that happen on one of my playthroughs. Now, this game, because it is base building, it's got a bit of a learning curve, and fully expect your first community to die horribly and depressed, more than likely. That's what's going on with mine, which is unfortunate, despite the fact I'm trying everything in the world. You can also encounter other survivors in the world. You can do trades with other Enclave people. They can become hostile to you, though thankfully that didn't happen during my experience. There are vehicles you can drive around in. And this is where it's going to get a little bit subjective. I like the combat in this game. I don't like the learning curve to the base building, but I think that's sort of what this is supposed to be, a survival simulator, not unlike, say, Rust, I'm guessing, or what the proposed Fallout 76 might very well be, an online survival RPG, which there is co-op in this game, though it's more like having a companion with you as opposed to true co-op. I didn't get a chance to mess around with that too much simply because not a lot of my friends had this game. However, that being said, if you have this game, if you have the Xbox Live Game Pass, you can get this game. So back to my experience with this. Combat was fun, especially when I had guns. And guns weren't super hard to come by. Ammo was a little scarce, but never so much so where you felt like, oh my god, I don't have any guns, what am I going to do? Bladed weapons were probably my favorite, especially like the Kukri or just basically the machete, so I could like Jason my way through people. I was hacking off limbs and cutting heads in half. That was pretty badass. There is a skill tree, which are pretty easy to max out, which you can do via searching or running or special killing zombies, stuff like that. And eventually those characters can be promoted to leaders within your community and they give buffs to other characters that are with them when you go out searching in the world. I liked this game in the fact that, like I said, combat was fun. I liked the idea of this. I think what I don't like about State of Decay 2 is I had a lot of tech problems. The AI is stupid, like beyond stupid at times. I could pick them off at a distance. They wouldn't hear the gunshot. Or I could sit there and just hack up a zombie and they wouldn't fight back. I had multiple clippings. I'd have zombies spawn above the road when I was driving around. And it was just glitchy, to say the very least. Or sometimes certain building things wouldn't work. When I had all the necessary requirements to do it, the buttons just wouldn't let me activate it for whatever reason. And I don't think that was a requirement problem on my end. I think State of Decay 2, I think the best way to experience this game is probably via Xbox Game Pass, where typically you're not going to be shelling out between $40 and $60 if you get the Ultimate Edition of this game, where you can play this game at your leisure and you're not having to shell out for a full title that if you don't like it, you're not stuck with it. So my opinion of State of Decay 2 is just that. Give it a try. I think this game could have been a lot stronger if maybe it had, say, the Walking Dead license associated with it. Then that would have got my attention a lot more. But then again, you couldn't have done the Blood Plague with it. But whatever. State of Decay 2 is a rent at best. Maybe worth buying if it comes out cheaper in a couple of months. And that is what we have to say here on This Week in Geek.
News on the mark!
Thank you much for viewing State of Decay 2. Looks like a game that's worth the Xbox Pass, but not really a full buy.
Yeah, and you know what? I've heard a lot of people talking about this game online where it improves upon the original, but not nearly enough. And it's kind of disappointing because the concept is good. It's just really, really repetitious, and that's kind of what killed it for me. However, that being said, after my review, I did go back and play it for a few more hours. Did have more fun than I thought I was going to, but I can't picture dishing out full retail for this price, even though this game is available at not full retail. Like, you can get the Ultimate Edition is $60, the regular edition is like $40.
Mm-hmm.
This is an Xbox Game Pass game for sure. At least until the price drops to $20, then yeah, sure, grab it for sure.
You mentioned repetitious. The entire genre feels repetitious now. There's been so many zombie games that have come out over the last 10 years. It feels kind of overdone at this point.
Yeah, I know. I mean, one of my favorite reviewers and friends of the show, Angry Joe, there's a running gag where he's like, "Hey, Joe, want to play another zombie game?" And yeah, it's just how it's become. It's just zombie game after zombie game. And it all started, obviously, with Resident Evil back in the 90s. Even before that was Sweet Home. But if you think about Left 4 Dead, Left 4 Dead 2, Dead Island, Dead Rising, and even games that use the Walking Dead license vary in quality. Like if they're the Telltale games, they're fantastic almost consistently. But if you look the one that came out from Terminal Reality, the same guys who developed the Ghostbusters game back in 2009, that game sucked. And it sucks because they got Michael Rooker and Norman Reedus to reprise Daryl Dixon and Merle Dixon for that game. But that game was hot, hot, steaming piles of garbage. But anyway, we got a lot more gaming news to talk about this week, as we have to talk about the world that is, was, and forever shall be in the history books. But before we talk about gaming news, which is fun and exciting, we got to talk about the big elephant in the room.
Controversy.
Controversy. Everybody's talking about it. Does this story even need any introduction? So this past week, actress Roseanne Barr went on Twitter, everyone's favorite political platform, and decided to say some rather racist things about a former Obama administration aide, basically comparing her to a character from Planet of the Apes. And then she went off on some conspiracy theory tweets about some other people, and ABC said, yep, well, nope, and pulled the plug on her show almost immediately, and wiping it from all the Viacom libraries. Hulu, CMT pulled it, Paramount Networks pulled it. It's basically like she was like Thanos from the history books altogether. And she was supposed to go on the Joe Rogan podcast on Friday and defend herself and explain herself. She then basically took a leave of absence from Twitter. She tried to explain that, oh, she was Ambien tweeting. And the pharmaceutical company hit back at her and says,
I love this.
While our drug has many side effects, racism is not known to be one of them. She thankfully left the platform. However, though, there's been rumblings and rumors that the Roseanne show could potentially carry on without the Roseanne character. ABC is potentially interested in having John Goodman and other characters from that show, such as Dan and Jackie, Darlene, etc., move forward without the Roseanne matriarchal character, because at the end of the season, she goes into surgery. So she could die on the... She could pull a Charlie Harper from Two and a Half Men. The character could simply just be killed off. What do you think about all this?
It's obvious that she made a very grave error, and no one could ever be excused for what she said. But I'd like to see the show continue, almost out of spite, but just because the rest of the actors have such a passion for the project, such a passion for Roseanne as a show, that it was obvious that they were pretty much right back into the original roles they had.
Oh, yeah.
So they should be able to continue playing those roles and enjoying what they're creating. I'd like to see the Connors come out instead of it being called Roseanne.
Yeah, because
obviously
exactly.
You're going to remove this character from existence.
Yeah, because honestly, you could wrap up Roseanne's character arc in one, maybe two episodes. Okay, you come back to the season premiere, she has died, and you have the grieving family.
It's kind of fitting, since in the original run of Roseanne, Dan dies, and then it's a season without Dan. Now it could be a season without
Roseanne.
Or forever now, without Roseanne, she's done.
Oh yeah, she is. You know what? It wouldn't surprise me if Fox offers her a project, because that's what they do. Racist? Are you conservative? Well, let me roll the red carpet for you, sir.
I think I saw a satire article about that. Fox picks up Roseanne because they don't mind casual racism.
It's ridiculous. But yeah, like, I think it'd be great, because so many writers, producers, obviously the actors behind Roseanne lost their jobs because of one stupid motherfucker. And I've seen people on Facebook trying to defend this, which is weird. I had one guy, he's like, I stand behind Roseanne. And I'm just like, hi, Ayla, are you having fun there, kitty?
I am a pillow.
Yeah, my cat Ayla, who loves almost nobody except me, is passed right out on Tristan. In fact, Blair's never going to believe this, so I got to take a picture of this.
Ayla's usually very skittish around me when I'm in the studio and recording, but today, no, she seems quite comfortable with me.
She's like, yep, you're a pillow. Anyway, back to Roseanne. Yeah, I mean, now, Roseanne has said She's trying to blame this on Ambien, mental health issues, but she has a history of being basically a bigot.
She it's well known that she is a Trump supporter, and she was trying to work that into the content of the new Roseanne show. And while it was shoehorned kind of everywhere in there, it wasn't overbearing.
It wasn't super in your face?
Yeah, it was obvious that it was there, but it wasn't overboard. So I was willing to accept that. But she's now taking this entire support of Trump thing obviously too far and shown that her original idea of you could be a Trump supporter and still be a good person, well, you're not making a good case for it there.
See, wouldn't it be funny if Trump hires her as, like, the press secretary?
Maybe she can be the equivalent aide to the ones
he made.
See,
give it time, and I guarantee you, it wouldn't... in bizarro world, which we're clearly living in, it wouldn't surprise me if somehow she gets tapped to do Trump's version of the correspondence dinner. Or something like that, rather than Trevor Noah or Stephen Colbert or somebody like that, or Jon Stewart hosting it. It'll be someone like Barr who has an appreciation for the Trump government. And we try not to get too political here on Twig. I mean, even last week I went on a rant about gun control for like 10 minutes. But yeah, so that's enough of that story. Roseanne, I hope the show continues, though. Roseanne Barr, you can fuck right off.
I hope you fade into obscurity.
Have fun there with Michael Richards. I'm sure you two could have a wonderful project together on Fox. Moving on, though, in other big news that's up in your face this week, Bethesda. Bethesda, the company that brought us The Elder Scrolls, brought us Fallout. Well, they dropped the bomb this week. Set us up the bomb, if you will.
What a lead-up. What a lead-up to it. Ugh. Bethesda... One of the things I love about Bethesda is how much they like to tease and build up to big announcements. They love to give you little tiny pieces and let you work out the puzzle. They left a stream on for a full day with just "please stand by" and the internet exploded. So you could find links to the stream and pictures on Instagram and Twitter everywhere. Oh my god, Bethesda's announcing something for Fallout, because the whole "please stand by," I don't remember what they're called, but the image, the standby image, yeah, for the video.
The test pattern, yeah.
That's the one, test pattern, thank you. Embarrassing. It was exciting. And then the morning of the announcement, they made little changes. They added a little vault boy in there, a little watch showing a certain time of day. And so everyone was getting even more excited, trying to figure out what did they mean. And they were being careful not to show the back of the vault boy because that would have released too much information. People were speculating. It was crazy to watch the community just go nuts over basically very little on screen.
Oh, yeah. It was cool. And then Bethesda dropped the teaser where it's like, the war is over. The Fallout is gone. Now we must rebuild. And it shows the inside of a vault, Vault 76 to be specific. And according to sources close to Kotaku, though spoke on the grounds of anonymity to protect their careers, Vault 76 is supposed to be an online survival RPG. So much like how I talked about State of Decay 2 at the beginning of this podcast, it sounds like they want Fallout 76 or Vault 76 to be similar to Rust and DayZ, where it's a persistent world. Originally, they wanted it to be Fallout 4, but with multiplayer. But it seems to have grown in scope over the last couple of years in terms of what they want to do. They still say there'll be quests, there'll be storyline stuff. And this is where it gets hard. I love the Fallout universe. I really do. But I don't want people in my Fallout. Co-op, maybe?
I don't know how I feel, really. I like the single-player Fallout. That's what it's known for. But at the same time, I am excited for a multiplayer experience. I would like to be in a world kind of like Borderlands. I'd like to see Fallout in the Borderlands... Not style, but in the actual gameplay with other people, where your character is your character, mm-hmm. but you can hot drop into these other people's worlds. Maybe you can have your own home world, but you can go help other people with theirs. So each person has their own instance of wherever Fallout 76 is going to be taking place, but you're able to cooperate there. I don't know. That's just my wants out of it, but I doubt it's going to be that way. I'm sure they have everything set out. E3's right around the corner. We're going to find out a whole bunch more information
there. Oh, yeah.
There.
Like, absolutely. Like, I'm pretty sure now Bethesda has a theme with how they announce Fallout games. Typically, they show some kind of lead-up information. They talk about it. They talk about it at E3, and then it's released later on that year. So, predicting this game will not release in October. It will release in November, December. It will be a holiday title, which means it's not competing against Call of Duty Black Ops. It's not competing against Battlefield V and what other big titles are coming out. Because Rage 2 is the other big Bethesda title that got announced last month. And it already has a release window of 2019. So we'll see Vault 76 this year, likely. However, there's a little bit more Fallout news you may not know. This is the 10-year anniversary of Fallout 3. And on Steam, there's a website, it's called SteamDB or something like that, where it tracks down when new versions are uploaded. Fallout 3 just got a 5.5 gigabyte DLC for it. Nobody knows what that does. Now, it could be Creation Club. It could be what happened with Fallout or with Skyrim Special Edition, which basically added updated graphics and all that shit, or on consoles how it gave us Creators Club, stuff like that. So my guess is we will see Fallout 3 Anniversary Edition or Remastered Edition for the Switch. But I imagine we'll see it for other consoles as well. What I'd like to see, and what other people have done via the Creation Club and the mod community, they've recreated New Vegas in Fallout 4. They've recreated parts of Fallout 3, like the Capital Wasteland. Obviously, we just have to wait over a week and change. We will have extensive E3 coverage here on Twig with Alex and Tristan, if he happens to be around. Really, really looking forward to it. I am personally hoping that I can play Vault 76 offline, because I don't want people stealing my shit, for one, or screwing up my community, because you know they're going to bring back base building, because it was such a big component of Fallout 4.
My understanding is that there is a building element to it. It's a survival style game, although that's kind of every game lately is survival and construction.
Survival or Battle Royale?
Yeah, I hope there's no Battle Royale on that. I'm sorry, it's overdone. Call of Duty, I'm excited for that, because it'll be very basic but enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it needs to be in every title. And Fallout, it's an RPG.
Yeah, exactly. And if you wanted Fallout Battle Royale, technically you had Nuka World, where there was, well, that one scene where you fought a bunch of guys, but it wasn't true Battle Royale. Anyway, getting off to our next topic. Coming up for our next topic, this is going to be something you're more of an expert on than I am.
I am a huge Pocket Monster, or Pokemon, as everyone calls them, fan, and I have been since the original releases of Pokemon Red and Blue. More importantly, Pokemon Yellow, which is being essentially remade and reimagined with Pokemon Go integration in two new titles announced by Nintendo, Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu and Let's Go Eevee.
Admittedly, I want the Eevee version.
Maybe not the catchiest titles in the world, but they look very exciting. They look like they are a modern adaptation of a very classic game, and they're coming to Nintendo Switch. This is what people have been waiting for, a Pokemon announcement for the Switch. I am beyond excited for this, even though it is not a core RPG game for the Pokemon series. They made that very clear. This is not in the same style as the core games have been, like Diamond, Platinum, Silver, Gold, Ruby, etc., etc. It is a more casually aimed Pokemon title. It uses many of the same systems as Pokemon Go, such as the catching mechanics. Instead of it being weaken the Pokemon down and then select Pokeball and then hope it catches a Pokemon, you will be using the Joy-Con to throw a Pokeball in the same way that you would in Pokemon Go, with the circles growing and shrinking.
But there's a Pokemon controller for this game, right?
Yes, they are also putting out a very specialized Joy-Con controller in the shape of a Pokeball, which you can also use to upload a Pokemon from Let's Go Pikachu or Eevee into the controller that you can then take with you around places if you're the type of person that wants to wear a Joy-Con somewhere on you at all times. It's a bit weird, kind of cool. You'll also be able to send Pokemon from Pokemon Go into Pokemon Let's Go and send some other things, we're not really sure exactly what, from Pokemon Let's Go into your Pokemon Go. So there's integration there, two ways. It's yet to see exactly how that's going to work. I'm not sure you're going to be able to just transfer your Dragonite or your Ho-Oh from Pokemon Go directly into this game, but I'm imagining something like a Pokemon Park system where you're able to interact with them there, maybe get certain special benefits for the rest of the game, but not really directly interact.
I'd like to know how the Pokemon online service will work, because I know there's the Pokemon Bank and whatnot, so I wonder if you'll be able to access that. Now, you were mentioning that you're allowed to transfer data from Pokemon Go into this. For example, my companion character in Pokemon Go on my phone is Dr. Wily. It's an evolved Meowth who's now a Persian. So I can have that. But I always have Eevee or Pikachu on my shoulder, right?
I'm not entirely sure how it's supposed to work. I know in original Pokemon Yellow, you had to have Pikachu on your team. Pikachu followed you behind you at all times. It was really cool and it was innovative and based off of the original anime. But I'm not sure if this new title is going to force you to have Pikachu or Eevee on your team, or whether they're just going to be part of it, maybe on the side, besides your regular team of six. There's not a lot of information released yet on the specifics of how those things are going to work.
We'll find out more at a Nintendo Direct in like a week and a half. Right?
Exactly. There's a lot of information to come yet. We're going to see how the systems work exactly, how everything's going to integrate with each other, how you're going to be able to use Pokemon Go to interface with Pokemon Let's Go, what kind of two-way communication there is there. Can you actually bring the Pokemon from your Go into the Switch and vice versa? We don't know yet, but that's coming up soon. The game is slated for release in mid-November, I believe the 16th. Don't quote me on that because I don't have a calendar in front of me.
It'll be a Sunday or a Tuesday. My guess, it'll be Pokemon Sunday, which means if this game does have Pokemon Go integration, Niantic, I think, is the company.
Yeah, Niantic is our Pokemon Go developer.
I can only imagine how hard their servers are going to get slammed that day.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is an opportunity for a new generation of Pokemon players to enter the core games. Because it's reminiscent of a core game. It has a lot of the same things in common with the core RPGs, but it's meant to be more casual and bring the players from Pokemon Go into the core series. Most new Pokemon players, most young Pokemon players, didn't really get involved with the first generation.
Yeah.
So this brings them back to those basics.
Yeah, it brings them back to Kanto.
And it brings them into the more complicated world that is the regular Pokemon game. So there's a lot more nuance to the full-fledged games than there are to Pokemon Go. Battling is different. The type advantages are the same, but they're more important.
Mm-hmm.
And even with this release, there's going to be a never-before-seen Pokemon added to this game, which is rumored and expected to be the first Pokemon from Generation 8, which is slated for release next year, 2019.
Now, well, odds are that'll be a proper Switch game.
Yes,
because
they said it'll
be 3DS core. Is effectively done.
Yeah, it's going to be a Pokemon core RPG on Nintendo Switch in late 2019.
So that'll be their big holiday game. Guarantee you that's a game that'll sell systems.
Absolutely. I think this one's going to sell systems
absolutely.
By itself.
There'll be a shortage around holiday.
But then next year it's going to explode. There's so many good games coming out, but Pokemon has been one of those names that has been coming up over and over again. When's a Pokemon game coming up for Switch? When are we going to have a Pokemon title? Everyone's been waiting for a full console release. And while there have been enjoyable console Pokemon games like Pokemon Snap, Pokemon Stadium, they aren't core games by any stretch of imagination. So people have been waiting for it.
I'm actually really surprised there was never a Pokemon Snap for the 3DS, especially with its camera function.
Yeah, it is fairly surprising. It feels like something they could have put in like an AR Pokemon Snap.
Yeah, I mean, considering like every 3DS came with those AR cards, which I'm pretty sure everybody threw out within like 10 minutes.
I didn't mean to throw mine out, but I lost them. They're probably somewhere in the couch cushions. I have no idea.
So that's pretty much what we have going on in the world of Geek, Dork, and Dweeb this week. Once again, if you want to get involved with the show, you can always email us, feedback@thisweekingeek.net, or you can leave a comment on the website, which is obviously thisweekingeek.net. We always look forward to hearing from you. So we're going to throw things over to me and Tristan again, and we're going to talk about the weird, the wonderful, the just plain strange world of the weird news. We'll be right back, guys, right after this, right here on Twig, the flagship of stupidity.
What makes you qualified to be a reporter?
I'm willing to violate anyone's privacy for my personal gain and then claim with a straight face that the public has a right to know.
By the hand of Zeus, what manner of deviltry is this?
I love fake alien poop day.
Welcome back to Twig, the flagship of stupidity. I never get tired of hearing our weird news intro because what gives me the right to be a reporter? And Dogbert said it best. Anyway, guys, we are back right here talking about Twig's weird news. And this is where we talk about the strange, the wonderful, the occasionally goofy, and sometimes the just plain what the hell is wrong with people. We're going to talk about something kind of fun today. As you guys know, I am a huge space nerd, not quite to the same level as Will Wheaton, the original space nerd himself.
Will Wheaton.
Wheaton. We're gonna talk about NASA's golden records. And for those of you that don't necessarily know what the golden records are, it's not just a MacGuffin from the Beast Wars TV show. Wow! Throwing some knowledge out there. Whoa. But no. The golden records were originally put on the Voyager 1 and 2 space probes back in the 70s and early 80s. And what these things are, they hold 117 pictures, the sounds of a humpback whale, greetings in 54 languages, a 20-minute sound essay of life on planet Earth, and a 90-minute romp through the planet's music, which is decidedly, well, sort of showing all the aspects of humanity from like jazz, rock, reggae,
classical.
Everything. Classical, yeah. Every possible thing you can imagine. So people such as Rebecca Orchard and Sherry Wells, both at the at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, said the golden record is a beautiful artifact and a representation of how humans want to see themselves, but is it meant to be received by and interpreted by something that has the sensory capabilities of the average human? If the second one of these senses is absent, or an entirely different sense is added, the golden record becomes a bit confusing. So, these researchers are part of the National Space Society meeting that happened in Los Angeles last Saturday. So these two researchers, Orchard and Wells Jensen, went through some of the material that was on the record and considered what alien civilizations might think with a different suite of senses. The barrage of greetings pile up in a way that could be constructed as arguing in a language that has no grammatical congruity. That is, if these people can even hear at all. The gold-plated copper disc has audio on one side and images on the other. This could also lead to misunderstanding. If alien civilizations tried to match sounds to the objects, life on Earth can look very strange. Like, what if they pair an image of an open daffodil with the roar of a chainsaw? So, perhaps the most baffling of all would be music, which ranges from Bach and... wow, can't pronounce some of these. Stravinsky to Japanese gamelan and Bulgarian folk music. I obviously can't say how these differences in translations would be interpreted, but what I can say is it definitely creates a puzzle for a listener who would be completely unfamiliar with humans and the noises that they make. What this project has shown me is that we really can't control what impressions we make. I think the fact of the satellite itself will be doing a lot of the talking. I hope that the mere fact that we've endeavored to send a record of humanity shows something all about our humanity. Which is kind of fun because Voyager 1 is past the heliosphere, which is technically an interstellar space right now.
Though it's done that about 8 times now because we keep debating, well, not we, but scientists keep debating on what exactly the heliosphere is, how far it goes. So that definition's been fuzzy. But the point is, it is way the hell out there.
As far as I understand, it's the absence of solar wind.
Yeah, it's where all that, the atmosphere of the, I say air quotes, the atmosphere of the sun kind of ends. But it's so hard to measure that from our position in space.
Well, yeah, because once it enters the Kuiper Belt, we don't know what's out there. It's just comets and potentially a red dwarf star or a dwarf planet out there. We don't know.
When you consider that the solar wind is moving outward, it's really hard to measure where it's going if we can't really see it. It's not coming back to our instrumentation.
Yeah.
Any of our observations are kind of in the wrong place. The only thing we could observe with from the outside is Voyager 1, which is already
out
there.
And it's not even the furthest object. I think there's a Mariner 1 or something. There's a Mercury probe or some other probe that was launched in like the late 60s, early 70s is the furthest man-made object, but it's no longer transmitting. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still transmitting, even though most of the instrumentation has been powered down. But I just find that tremendously interesting. Just thinking, could this end up like Beast Wars and someone finds it? Or is this like the beginning of the Borg? Obviously, Nutty Buddy theories there. But no, just the fact that when humanity is all said and done and things are gone and we are nothing but a memory upon this planet, knowing that a small piece of us survives out there in the cosmos, it's kind of inspiring that like we're not like Carl Sagan's little blue dot. Part of us has survived. Now, admittedly, pitted with micrometeors, radiation, whatever else has happened to the probe.
Yeah, if
it's
even
still exists.
If it's even recognizable or discernible in any way. Like I said, if any alien civilization does eventually come across this probe, and it's a good 40,000 years before it even crosses any other stellar system.
Yeah.
We're going to look weird. They
Plus
may not
all
understand
the garbage information we're sending out into the galaxy now.
Yeah, our radio signals are probably indiscernible, but just because of how things like that work, they're getting weaker as they go out into space. We basically don't exist because no one could notice us. But the sheer vastness of space, the distance between things, makes it very difficult to understand what was there even a short distance ago. You can't see that level of detail. So having something physical that far out, it brings a potential saying, oh, hey, there was something there. Even though by the time anything comes across it, we're probably all dead.
Exactly. We're just another civilization gone to cosmic dust. And now that we've had this great philosophical debate, let's have another one, because yours is, oh, delightfully terrifying.
It's a little bit more immediate in its concern. And everyone knows about Google Home and other assistants. You know Alexa, you know Google, you know Siri. But people are starting to use their Google Home assistants for pretty much everything in their house, from turning on lights and changing the temperature in the room to playing music and ambience and answering questions for you, all the usual things. Very mundane, very day-to-day tasks. Well, Alexander Rebin has art projects. He likes to tinker with stuff, and I can appreciate that. I like to take things apart. I can't put them back together, but I can take them apart.
Mm-hmm.
But he builds these art pieces and these conceptual pieces, and he connected his Google Home Assistant to servos that activated an airsoft gun. And he put out a short clip that shows him activating his Google Home Assistant, just telling it to activate gun. It takes a moment to process it. It says, okay, turning on the gun, and fires and shoots an apple off of a pedestal. It raises the question, what else? Like, you could rig your Google Home Assistant to
with
just
automated turrets.
Exactly. You could just fire guns. You could say, oh, hey, Google, kill that intruder.
If you had imaging software that could recognize what a human shape looks like, you could literally program the thing. If anything enters between X hour and X hour, shoot.
There's already security systems that detect motion and faces. It'll say, hey, you know, this person entered this room. Do you recognize this person? Yes or no? And you have to confirm, yes or no, I recognize this person. You could potentially automate it where, oh, okay, well, no, I don't recognize
the
person.
Here's a database of people.
And it tases them or shoots them.
Jesus. This is some Shadowrun cyberpunk shit right here. The potential for this to be used and abused, but also technologically advanced too, like you were mentioning, having security systems automated like this, having tasers or having it use ballistic gel rounds, which are meant to incapacitate, riot weapons.
Yeah, and these are things that aren't far-fetched. These are things you can basically jury-rig if you have the know-how.
Yeah, basically, if you have Amazon, you can order this crap. If you live in America, you can Amazon order guns, I think. And you could literally order a Alexa or a Google Home Assistant. And if you have the technological know-how and you're a bit of a mad scientist, like, say, I don't know, our good friend Dr. Terawatt in Toronto, you could most certainly create an automated death machine with this thing. And it's kind of terrifying because I know Google was talking about creating drone software that could be used in military projects. This guy's a civilian, and he figured out how to make this happen. Now, admittedly, it's just servos and having it follow a command structure of Google activate gun. But if you got some more sophisticated software and more sophisticated hardware in there, the potential for this thing for home security is definitely there. Obviously, until it, you know, blows off the wrong limb or something terrible equivalent to that, we'll have to wait and see. But man, that's
scary.
It is. It truly is. Because as we move into the further areas of automation, security, and even just artificial intelligence now, how long until security becomes more and more automated? Like, there's a video game I play called Watch Dogs 2, and they have automated security drones that just wander around. There's automated security guards in San Francisco, where they're supposed to deter the homeless. And One of those robots got covered in barbecue sauce a few weeks ago. Thanks to Alex for covering that story. But yeah, just imagine if you could implant weapons. And I want to say there's a Geneva Convention against that, where you can't have automated weapons on the field or something like that. Like, yeah, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I feel like there are certain rules of war now that there's only certain things. There's stipulations saying you can't.
Like, I'm still waiting. Like, do you remember in Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines where they had the T-1 and it was that tank tread with the two chain guns on the side? Okay, honestly surprised we haven't seen those. Or HK drones. I guess we basically have drones now.
Yeah.
But they're man-piloted, or even some of them are probably automated. There's got to be.
I guarantee they're automated. The most recent Time magazine cover, it's all drones. So they are in formation, and I guarantee those 950-something drones that they were using to make that cover, that is not people.
You'd have to be one hell of a skilled pilot.
Like, so that is an automated formation. So automated drones exist. You just basically program them to do certain things, and they go do it.
I mean, we're going to have a review of a drone here on Twig. A company sent me one a couple months ago, and I just haven't been able to get outside to fly this thing. So I'm part of the problem now. And evidently I'm supposed to file a flight plan with the city of Guelph.
Jeez.
With this thing. And I guess I should. But still. Anyway, now that we've discussed philosophy of life, the universe, and insignificance to Skynet literally coming to kill us at some point. We always end this show on such a cheery note. So we're going to throw things over to Satan's pantry. Which I'm sure is delicious this week. So we'll be back right here on Twig, the flagship of stupidity. Hopefully you've enjoyed our rantings, ravings, and our, of course, doomsday prophecies.
Welcome to hell.
You wouldn't even serve it to a pig. It's inedible.
Welcome out to Satan's Pantry, where we decide to go down the grocery aisle. But today we're actually visiting the baker's section of the grocery store. Well, actually, more rather, we did this in my own kitchen. That's right. This is a home-brewed Satan's Pantry today.
Ooh,
and this is
shit.
Brought to you by my wife, Blair, who decided to do something rather nice for one of our mutual friends, Kelly, because she eats a very specific diet. So today, you folks are going to try what is known as a vegan brownie. Now, to describe this thing, let's be frank, it looks like a piece of shit.
It looks like the wads, or what was it, a wad they called it in the movie Accepted, where that guy, Glenn, ended up being a chef and he put every flavor together.
Yeah, it looks like a dog turd. It looks like something you'd find on the lawn after the winter's gone. But who wants to go first? Obviously, I know what this tastes like.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing I'll say about this is I almost want us to place a whole bunch on the front lawn. And then when somebody walks by,
just
pick
it
up and just go, oh, look at that. And then just put one in your mouth.
Candy.
I'd just say, oh, lawn apples. And then just pick one up.
But all right, Alex, you have volunteered to go first. Right. And then after everybody's tasted, Blair will tell us what was actually in this.
One bite?
They're
bite.
Nature's brownies.
Go for it.
Mm. Alex is chewing. He doesn't look too perturbed.
Alex is continuing to chew.
If I can describe it, it's much crumblier than a normal brownie. It's not as like a buttery
moist.
No, it's actually not too bad. It's not too dry. It does have a chocolate flavor, but it doesn't taste off at all. It would just taste like somebody made brownies that are pretty good but not great.
Okay. All right, Tristan, you go next.
I was gonna say, they smell almost like they have peanut butter in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm. They don't really have peanut butter taste.
No, they don't.
They're not bad, but they're like, oh, Grandma made the weird brownies this time.
I'll say they are a little dry. It's a little dry.
I'm wondering.
It's drier than regular brownie.
Oh, think about this. What is it? Two, three months away? Vegan weed brownies will be a thing in the future. Yeah. They're a thing now. They're a thing now, but they're a real thing that you can actually get.
Legal thing.
Exactly.
Go to a bakery and buy them.
Yeah. So I mean that'll be interesting.
All right, Lee, you're go.
It's okay. I don't mind it. Not as good as regular brownies.
I would say, like, okay. I'm not going to refuse this as a snack. Mm. Would I gravitate towards it? My question is, would the nutritional information be that different? Like, I'm
we actually figured it out.
It probably has less sugar to begin with.
I think it's a hint of banana.
A little bit, yeah.
I don't find it. I've actually had a foray into, like, sort of like gluten-free brownies before. I don't know if vegan
Heathen.
Is vegan gluten-free.
I think so.
They're not synonymous, but you'll find them. They like
they often overlap. Right,
I meant specifically. Are these gluten-free? Do you know?
Yes.
They are. Okay.
Because I was gonna say, like, you can get all the gluten you want and it still be vegan.
Right. This is not the if this is gluten-free. I've had experience with another gluten-free brownie. And it's not bad. This is pretty good, actually. Like, he's right. It's not the, it's grandma's secondary brownie, I guess.
Grandma ran out of the sugar.
Grandma's brownies are great. It's Great Aunt Helga's brownie, right. where it's not quite. It's grandma's brownie where she changed the recipe because she doesn't like that bitch.
She's using carob.
Yeah,
it's okay.
So I've had this. I had this last night for dinner with my friend Kelly. And I actually rather like these. Like I said, like, I get a really strong flavor of cocoa. I can taste the banana that's in this. And
there's clearly banana in it.
Which, oh yeah, my wife Blair is going to come on my mic right now and explain how these were actually made.
She actually pooed them out.
Yes. I did. I took a giant dookie in a bowl and I just fed it to you gentlemen.
It doesn't taste like your dookie.
Are you sure?
Mind you, you smell vaguely of farts.
It doesn't taste like your dookie smells, if that makes any sense.
Friday night.
Okay, so in this, there is one cup of mashed banana.
I think you say mashed potatoes. Like, whoa.
Actually, you can make it with...
You can make it with what?
You can make it with sweet potato, actually, or black beans, alternatively.
So, you know what? I don't know. I mean, overall, I was actually rather impressed with it, all things considered.
You are also correct that there is indeed peanut butter in it.
Oh.
It didn't really taste like much, at least the part I smelled.
It's a hint.
I didn't taste it.
I'm wondering if it's, depending on how it was mixed and where it settled, if my piece didn't have as much.
So, there's bananas, peanut butter, chocolate protein powder, and I put a little bit of Splenda in it. And was that it?
You know what would be good in this,
though? And cocoa.
So these are entirely sugar-free, then, yeah. Except for the banana.
Do you know,
yes.
You know what would be good in this, though? Sugar and eggs and...
and
put
then,
a big old hunk of meat in there.
I just like a whole stick of butter.
Then after I found... I went through the bulk barn, or the candy bank, as we refer to it, and I tried to find vegan chocolate chips. They do not have any. In fact, I don't know what would be in a vegan chocolate chip.
Vegan chocolate chips, they're just like a mystical thing that for people to think that they want.
Seriously, they're carob chips. And the first time you try carob, you might like it a little bit. After that, it's just garbage.
But see, I like Baker's chocolate, so you probably could have got away with that.
Then I find out she's not vegan, she's vegetarian.
So I could have put real chocolate in it.
I thought they were the same thing for the longest time, and I'm pretty sure I've offended somebody, but
I didn't know vegan means chocolate. They don't eat any animal byproducts like eggs or milk or so anything like that.
What's in chocolate by nature that wouldn't be vegan?
Milk.
There's milk in chocolate specifically. I know milk chocolate, obviously.
But there's
but
milk,
like
there's milk in it,
or
there's cream, or there's butter.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Right, there's
a rich
byproducts.
Sort
yeah.
of a rich flavor is comes from...
Okay. From the...
I learned today.
Yeah.
I learned today.
And I think also the sugars and stuff, like, a lot of vegan stuff, it doesn't mean sugar-free, it just means generally if you're eating vegan, you're also eating low sugar to begin with.
Yeah.
It just sort of goes hand in hand.
But yeah, overall, so that
yeah.
sums up
I would
our
say it's good. Like, I would say that's maybe, if you get the recipe, maybe we should post it.
Yeah. So, we will make sure to do this when we revisit Satan's Pantry, when we try probably more vegan food in the future, or vegetarian, or whatever. So anyway, for Satan's Pantry, we'll catch you guys again next time as we delve into the devil's grocery aisle. And next week, we're going to try something a little bit sweet.
The fucking gremlin. Everything she touches, she screws. There you go.
Sorry, guys.
Hey, madam, this is not our first night.
Yes, chef, no chef.
Yes, chef, no chef. Fucking gremlin.
We are taking a look at The Fall of Delta Green by Kenneth Haidt, brought to us by Pelgrim Press. What is this game? This is based upon one of the coolest things I love in the Cthulhu mythos. Delta Green is actually a security clearance given to a government agency that specifically fights Cthulhu occult and unnatural threats to the world at large. You may be sent in against deep ones off the coast of Massachusetts. You could be sent off in the Himalayas fighting the Teko Teko people. It could be any number of different things. All you know is you are the last line of defense, and you are all that's staying between humanity and its ultimate destruction, which means likely you're not coming home. So this game is powered by the Gumshoe system. This is something we played on Terrible Warriors in Mutant City Blues a couple of years back. I wasn't a part of that gaming group, so I'm just reading the rules such as they are. I like how Gumshoe is more investigative in its nature, where basically you follow the clues that I give you as the game master. If you have the skill, it just automatically succeeds if it's investigative. Now, there are contests involving athletics, driving, firearms that may not succeed, but it all comes down to a single D6 and how much pool you're going to spend into it. Like I said, if you're familiar with Mutant City Blues, Trail of Cthulhu, then you know what I'm talking about. From a rule standpoint, I don't like the combat in this game, and I don't like how they handle stability and sanity, which are two separate things, basically how you handle the unnatural and stuff like that. And that is what's to be expected in a Delta Green game, is to have those elements from Call of Cthulhu and Trail of Cthulhu for you to having to deal with the mental trauma of knowing the true reality of the universe. However, mechanics aside, this is a gorgeous game. The book that we got sent here is fantastic, and it's a complete game. Because this is The Fall of Delta Green, this takes place during the 1960s, so it's a historical RPG. So satellites are just becoming a new thing, night vision is just becoming a thing, or at least night vision scope, stuff like that. They even mention at one time about pop cans, how we take the ordinary aluminum pull tab can for granted. Yeah, they even mentioned that's a new thing in 1961, I want to say. Stuff like that. But they also talk about some of the threats that you could encounter in this game. Like I mentioned, you could be fighting Migo, Deep Ones, Teko Teko people. You could be fighting an avatar of Narla Hotep or Azathoth or something like that. And it gives you other enemies too. You could be fighting cultists that are like Soviet GRU soldiers. You could be fighting an aspect of the Japanese government. There's so much into this. And they even give an explanation for the Majestic 12, which, if you're familiar with UFO conspiracy lore, they talk about they were helping to cover up the Roswell crash that happened in 1947. And there's this whole history that Kenneth has written in this game, where you look at ordinary events, but you see them through the lens of the Cthulhu mythos. And even real world people are mentioned in here, like this person might be the head of Majestic 4, like Operation Pluto or something like that. Or they talk about past
Delta Green operations, like Operation Lunacy. They even talk about the original Insalmoth raid back in 1928 and how the government became aware of unnatural forces, and now we have to worry about that. One of the cooler things I liked about this, they talk about the Roswell crash of 1947. And they talk about how the spacecraft wasn't powered by technology. It was powered by clay tablets that had runes and sigils and carved on them. And scientists were trying to figure it out. Eventually, one of them got squished by making his own. And another guy was sitting in his lab one night, and he carved a sigil onto something, and he just disintegrated. But not before he said, "Oh, it's so simple." And then just boom, guy was gone. It's so cool. I think The Fall of Delta Green is probably one of the prettiest books I've seen in a long time, too. It looks like it belongs from the 60s in a weird kind of way. It's got a psychedelic kind of color pattern to certain things. It looks like government dossiers thrown together. It's got a very cool just layout to it. It's one of the neater books I've seen in a really, really long time. However, though, that being said, I like this game, but I think the reason I appreciate it so much is because I do have an appreciation of the Cthulhu mythos. Could I play this game with a newbie group? With the gumshoe rules, yes. Mechanically, I think this is a game you could teach in a night. The world, however, if you want to play them as green Delta Green operatives, where maybe they come from the CIA, or they're just coming off of tour in Vietnam, and they encounter unnatural forces, you could play it like that, but I think you'll get the most rich experience is if you know a little bit about Cthulhu. If you've maybe played a couple games of Call of Cthulhu and Trail of Cthulhu, you kind of know what to expect. It's kind of a neat thing to realize, oh man, I'm going to face mind-blasting horror. Yeah, well, I got an M60 machine gun. Let's see what you got going on there, Mr. Deep One, or Mr. Cthuloid, or Starspawn of Cthulhu. I think this game is not noob-friendly, if I had to say anything about it. And it's not to say that it's a bad game, but I think you'd have to know your gaming group pretty well before you brought this out at the table. I think this is a game that requires a lot of preparation, especially because Delta Green relies on you having a civilian cover. They want you to be able to account for all your lies, and if you have to do something dirty, you have lies within lies and bulletproof alibis, so to speak. So if you really want to role play this game effectively, I think there's a lot of prep that has to go into it. It's not to say it can't be a rich and rewarding role play experience. There's just going to be something that comes with it. So that being said, that is my review of The Fall of Delta Green by Kenneth Haidt and Pelgrim Press. Definitely a worthy addition to your collection, but you're going to have to know your gaming group first before you can sit down and fight the Cthulhu mythos and be given the illustrious clearance of a Delta Green friendly.
Scanning. Control. Manipulate scientific data. Take over. Blast. Control. World government. Shut down infrastructure. Ship everything to China. Just look at this person.
Welcome back to the extra of the show as we say goodbye. Au revoir. I'm pretty sure I fucked that right up.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Yeah, I can't say that because I don't speak your Klingon language. That's what I'm going to call it right now, and I'm sticking to it. So anyway, guys, we've had a lot of fun on the show talking about a variety of different things. You just heard my review for The Fall of Delta Green from Pelgrim Press. Definitely something we're going to check out at some point. Don't know whether it's an appropriate game for Tristan and Alex and the other members of the Cambridge crew. We'll wait and see. Who knows? Maybe I'll change my mind over the summer as I prepare more of the games that we'll have a chance to play here on the show. But coming up on the site this week, like I said, we are still having some trouble with our RSS feeds. You should not need to have to resubscribe to anything. Our Apple iTunes feed should be redirected in a couple of days. So hopefully we'll have that fixed. So please stick with us. Once again, thisweekingeek.net will always work. You can always download the episodes directly. But the podcatching RSS software should catch up in a couple of days. So anyway, big thanks to Stephen Phillips for working on this. Same with Alex, the producer, for taking time out of their day to get this all fixed for us. For without it, this show would not exist. Coming up on the site this week, we are going to have a new Turd or Treasure. Me and Alex should also be recording a new commentary this week, where we've been doing our DVD commentaries of movies long forgotten on YouTube. I'm sure we'll find stupid Hulk Hogan or Billy Blank's movies. I'm hoping to actually do some more well-known movies in the future where you can actually buy them in stores, because I know I'm excited to talk about some Van Damme movies I have to review. I know I'm excited! In terms of reviews I'm working on, I'm currently working on Detroit Become Human. I'm working on some anime reviews I got from Mill Creek. I'm also working on a copy of the Sega Genesis collection I got for Xbox One. So big thanks to those guys who got me that. What do you got coming up on your YouTube show this week, Tristan?
Well, on YouTube, I'm talking about Sea of Thieves, The Hungering Deep, the first expansion. I say expansion, it's more of a large content patch that they have put out for the game. What's included, what still needs to be included, where the game is going in the future. I'm also working on a review for Wolverblade for the PS4, a nice little hack and slash game set in ancient Britain during the occupation by Rome.
Oh, that sounds kind of cool.
It's kind of a barbarian style, kind of let loose, lots of blood, lots of severed limbs. But it's in a 2D style. It's really weird. It's kind of cool.
Sounds fun. So yeah, we'll have those here on the show. If not, they will be on Turd or Treasure. I recorded a Altered Geek with Steve Megatron Phillips on the Geekcast Radio Network, which will be released here on Twig as well. We will also be doing Future Imperfect as we talk about the merger being halted between Paramount and CBS or something like that. Steve explained it to me. Like, basically, there's trouble in Star Trek land. But we'll find out what it means for you on Future Imperfect. So anyway, guys, until next time, we have been
Mr. Tristopher.
I've been Mike the Birdman Dodson. Live free or die hard. We'll catch you guys again next time right here on ThisWeekInGeek.net or Twig, the flagship of stupidity.
Okay, son, now you're starting to scare the viewers.
Just act normal.
I'd ask you to do the same, but I'm afraid that ship has sailed.
Why are there so many ostriches?
But you have a game that is dipped in the
ropey, thick, window cocking.
So guys, we'll be right back right here on This Week in Geek, only on ThisWeekInGeek.net and many other sites where I syndicate this crap, because I'm a media slut.
I like turtles.
Loose like your mom.
That's right.
No fisting, you say. Anything else you object to?
Me likey tater tots.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net for more geek content and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Follow and message us on Twitter at thisweekingeek. And check out our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. And if you're the good old-fashioned email type, send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time. And remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, me too, but, you know, I'm really wired. What do you say I take you home and eat your pussy?
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
I can't believe it.
That Gerald is presenting the quarterly budget report with finger puppets?
Look, here comes a 1.7% decrease in fixed overhead. Hello, everybody!
No, I can't believe how easy it was to save hundreds of dollars on my car insurance with Geico.
Who are you? The projected increase in organic Q3 revenue. Hooray!
Believe it. Geico could save you 15% or more on car insurance.